stories don't define you. How you tell them will. Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins, your host and chief story maker of Elkins Consulting. In my work with coaching clients, I guide people to improve their communication using storytelling as the foundation of our work together. What I've realized over years of coaching and podcasting is that the majority of people don't realize the impact of the stories they share on their internal messages and on the people they're sharing them with. My work with leaders and people who aspire to be leaders follows a similar path to the interviews on my podcast, uncovering pivotal moments in their lives and learning how to share them, to connect more authentically with others, to make their presentations and speaking more engaging, to reveal patterns that have kept them stuck or moved them forward, and to improve their relationships at work and at home. Today's guest is Joy Soto, and you are going to love her stories. Welcome to Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. With me today is a woman named Joy Soto that I met on LinkedIn, and we've had some interactions back and forth that were inspiring and insightful, and I just had to reach out and ask her to share some of her stories here on this podcast. So thanks for joining me, Joy.
Thanks for having me.
It's so good to see your face. Unfortunately, our podcast listeners don't get to see your pretty face and your warmth, and they don't get to see what the joy that you exude with your name, but I can describe it and hopefully they can imagine it. So the first thing I would like for you to do is kind of share with our audience what you do, what your specialty is really right now.
I give inspirational speeches, and right now it's through Zoom. I like giving them in person. That's kind of my specialty, but right now it's through Zoom, and it's really great connecting with people and inspiring people, especially during this really challenging time that we're having right now.
Thank you. And, you know, that's perfect because as we get into our conversation, our audience will start to understand what makes you a good person to be talking about inspiration and motivation. So terrific. So I always ask my guests to share something about themselves that most people might not know. And the reason I do that is I like to give our audience some context for the person that they're going to start to get to know through their personal stories. And it's always interesting. People surprise me sometimes. Sometimes it's not surprising, but it's wonderful to hear. So what do you think? Do you have an answer for that?
Let's see. Something that's interesting about me that people don't know. I feel like people know everything about me. I think one of the interesting things is that I was a dolphin trainer at one point in my life for a very long time, actually. So I would, so I would swim with them and work with them and care for them. And it was the most incredible experience of my life.
Wow. A dolphin trainer. I think I did see that kind of buried somewhere on your LinkedIn profile. Is that right?
There's a picture. That's it. There's like a picture of me up there with a dolphin.
Oh, wonderful. Maybe I just asked you about it in a message. I love that. A dolphin trainer. I think that's probably one of those things that as little kids, you have that idea that someday you're going to be a dolphin trainer, but it never actually happens. But you actually did that.
Yeah.
Is that something you wanted to do as a child, or is that something you fell into?
Well, I like different aspects of it that I kind of put together when I was in college. So I've always loved swimming, and I've always loved the water and the ocean and animals. So when I was in college, I was getting my degree for psychology, and I started to realize I didn't want to work with people.
No, I totally understand that.
But I just knew that I wasn't cut out to sit there and listen to people and help them in that way. So I thought, well, what else can I do? This is something that I've always seen, but I thought that it was impossible. And I was actually discouraged in the very beginning. I was told that it was impossible and not to even bother trying from people who worked in the industry. And then I kept trying and trying, and I did a lot of volunteer work and internships, and finally I got a paying job, and eventually ended up in SeaWorld San Diego.
Wow. I was there in 2009 in December. Were you still there then?
Yes, I was actually.
Oh, we might have seen you. That's very cool. You never know where you're going to cross paths, and if you don't tell those stories, you never find out, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool to think about.
Yeah, I like that. So I would love to hear more. You mentioned that you were
working with the, what was it, the Person of the Year Award? What? Tell me more about that.
Oh, I was nominated to be a candidate for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society's Man and Woman of the Year competition. So I started that late last year, and then we kind of went into COVID. So the time that it started was right when everything started shutting down with COVID. And so the majority of people I knew lost their jobs and everyone was struggling. And that's when we were supposed to raise all the money. So, but that's what it was. It's basically a nationwide competition. It's great. And all these people worked to raise money and awareness for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And so it was just a blessing to be able to be a part of it and to help in some way to raise funds to find a cure for cancer.
So there's obviously a reason that you were nominated to participate in that.
Well, the person who nominated me saw my TEDx, and my TEDx was about me when I had cancer and how I made a documentary on myself. And so she thought that I'd be a great candidate for it.
So tell me about the TEDx.
The TEDx. Okay, well, the TEDx was about basically what it was like to be a filmmaker making a documentary on a subject that happened to be me, and I was going through cancer at the time, so just kind of that struggle of wanting to get something on camera, but then it's like, okay, well, this is what's actually happening right now. I'm having my head shaved, and it's really emotional, so it was kind of challenging to do that, but it was very helpful actually to do that because it took my mind off of having cancer.
So you were documenting it as you went through the treatments and yeah. Kind of a distraction for you in a way, even though it was about the cancer and the treatments.
It was definitely a distraction because I would take the camera with me and I'd stay at the hospital for 5 days at a time. And I would ask the nurses if I could just use one of their rooms they're not using, and they'd let me. So I'd wheel my little IV with me to one of the rooms, and I'd go in there with my camera and my tripod, set it up, and then I just talked to the camera. And it was really therapeutic because it was just a lot of heavy stuff that I didn't have to tell anyone else. So it was good to be able to do that. And it was a goal that I had. So yeah, I had the goal of surviving, but it was something else that I had to focus on besides the cancer.
So education in some way.
So yeah, education and inspiration, because at that point, all I'd seen, and I love the movies, I just started film school when this happened, when I got sick. And so I, of course, rented all of these films that have people with cancer in them. And I saw these people who passed away, but I knew that there's millions upon millions of survivors out there. And so when I started this, what I wanted to do was show a story of survival, which was kind of terrifying at the same time because I didn't know what was going to happen. But that's what I set out to show, was a story of survival. And I did, which is fantastic.
Wow. Wow on so many levels. And the reason I say that is we kind of wonder, well, we don't wonder, we know the power of mindset. I mean, it's been documented over and over again. The neuroscience behind it has been clear and proven that our mindset can deeply impact our physical being. And the fact that you set out to record and document the survival story kind of predicted your survival in a way, because you were training your brain to survive this.
Yeah.
So cool.
And it was really interesting is that I remember this one moment that I had with a nurse before I started any chemotherapy, and she was taking my blood. And at that point I'd already found out that I had cancer and I'd have to go through chemotherapy. And so we were talking and I told her why I was there. And she looked at me, she said, you know what? You're going to be okay. I said, well, how do you know that? And she said, because I see a lot of people come over here who have cancer, and a lot of times they're defeated before they even start. But you're here with a smile on your face and with a great attitude, so I think you're going to be fine. I mean, and obviously things that there's a lot more that goes into it than that, but I think having a good attitude is huge.
Right, of course. Acknowledging pain and acknowledging suffering, and at the same time, seeing the light at the end and having that confidence that you're going to make it through. So what was the moment where you thought, I need to make a film about this? I mean, something must have triggered. Yeah. Okay. What was that story?
Well, I left working with dolphins, and because I kept thinking about film, I love editing, and I would just, I would be at work thinking about how I could edit something at home. So I left a job that I loved and I went to film school, and it was really exciting and scary at the same time, because I was doing something new and I wasn't, you know, I was brand new at it, which meant I wasn't great at it.
Right. That's always tricky. Yeah.
And so I had only one class under my belt, and it was like maybe a month and a half, 2 month class. And then I was at the very beginning stages of my next class, and we had Thanksgiving break. And that's when I found out that I had cancer. And so what in my mind was a good idea is, okay, I can't do all the physical work because it's really exhausting to do all these film shoots. But what I can do is I can still go to class and learn. I'd love to do that. And so I talked to the school. I don't even know why I called them, because I thought it was a no-brainer, but I just was like, okay, I'll just make sure it's okay. And I called them up and they said no, that I couldn't do that. I couldn't just go to class and not do the work, which I mean, to me now, I'm like, I didn't want to do the work. And they said no. That sounds crazy, right?
Darn it. You mean you won't let me get through it without doing the work?
Right. Well, and I said, well, I don't care if I don't get credit. I just want to learn. And they still said no to me. And so my journey learning about filmmaking and going down this new path that I just I just broken off of this old path onto a new one, and it had just stopped and I was in limbo. And so I had thought about it and about making a documentary on it. And then that was pretty much what set me over the edge, was just being told, no, you can't continue. And I thought, well, no, I can continue. I'll still keep learning by making a film on myself. And so I'll still set up things, you know, the lights, I have lights right here. I'll still set up lights and record things and edit it together and make a film about this. And that's how I can learn. So that's what I did.
You know, I just yesterday wrote a comment on a post that said, sometimes spite is a powerful motivator. And that, I mean, that's perfect timing for that comment, right?
Yeah.
Because that's basically what you did. You're like, okay, fine. I don't have to pay you for this class.
Right.
And you're going to miss out on my opportunity of making this something special, and you're missing out on it.
Yeah. Well, and I think it was also, you know, it was a roadblock in my life. It was all of a sudden something said, no, you can't do this. And it's just that thing inside of you that says, no, I still want to do this. I'm going to find a way. And then you go around the roadblock somehow. So that was me going around this roadblock that I encountered.
Well, you did the same thing when you wanted to be a dolphin trainer.
I did, actually.
People said no. So yeah, clearly you're inspired to a certain extent by spite. Like, you don't tell me I can't do that. Watch
right.
me.
Yeah.
That whole commercial, here, hold my beer, right? Except that, you know, you're thinking about it and it's not a stupid risk you're taking. So, but still, I mean, I keep thinking about that. Our sons were totally fascinated by that commercial, hold my beer, watch this.
Yeah.
And they have all these memes about it. And now my boys are 19 and 21. And so that, you know, I'm so relieved that they found the humor in it, as opposed to, you know, wanting to emulate it in any way.
Yeah.
But I think it's actually a really important concept, because when somebody says no, and you say, I'm not taking that for an answer. It definitely demonstrates your resilience and persistence. It also demonstrates part of what motivates you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you're on the phone. Was it all over the phone? And was it multiple calls that you had to talk to the film school, or was it just a one-time conversation?
It was a one-time conversation. I remember I was in a parking lot talking to them, and it was dark out. I think it was,
sitting in the car.
Yeah, sitting in my car. So I haven't thought about that in so long. So that's where it happened, outside the film school. And that's when they told me that there was nothing that they could do, and that's it. There was no other discussion. There wasn't anyone else for me to talk to. That was it. So
you're in the parking lot at the school. Why were you in the parking lot?
I think, I don't remember, honestly. I don't remember if I went there to say goodbye to people or what, because I did have a moment where I said goodbye to my teacher and said I wouldn't be back because I had cancer. And I remember walking by my chair that I had sat in before Thanksgiving break, thinking, I felt like I dropped off the face of the planet, basically, because I walked by that chair and it was empty, and it would remain empty while everyone else returned back to school. So I don't know if that's what it was, but I just remember that moment of being in, you know, in the dark in a car talking to them and getting that bad news.
Did you cry? Because I would have been bawling. What do you mean no? I'm already suffering and you're adding to my suffer.
Yeah. I don't know if I cried or if I was just in shock. Like, I can't believe that. Yeah, for some reason, I thought I had a cancer card to play. You know, like, oh, you know.
Oh, there's the truth. That's where it comes out. I have a card to play, so they have to say yes to me.
Why would you say to someone who just found out they have cancer, doesn't know if they're going to survive, no, you can't just go to school and learn, even if you're telling me that you don't care about the credit. You can't. Like that, to me, that's just ridiculous. That someone
it
would say
is
no to
ridiculous. Me. It's absurd.
No.
Wow. So here we are. You're sitting in the car. You find out they say this. You're so in shock that they would even react that way. So with such discompassion, like this absolute disconnect from their own humanity. I mean, was it just one person that you talked to?
It was just one person that I talked to. Yeah.
Was it a man or a woman?
It was a woman.
Yeah. And do you have her voice in your head at all?
I just have it as being very flat and cold, like no, no emotion. No, I'm sorry that you have cancer or like no concern at all. Just right. No, there's nothing.
Nope. There's nothing we can do. So, I wonder if she'd heard that before, you know, like if she was kind of cynical because of people's excuses in the past and maybe she thought you were making it up or something. I don't know. I know we are complicated human beings and I hate to just paint her with this, as my friend Amber Johnson says, freeze her in time for that one interaction because there's probably a lot more to it from her side of it. At the same time, it makes me wonder, you're sitting in the car, you hear this, you're so in shock and my guess is that you're sitting there now, you're imagining yourself in there and visualizing it again. Do you see anything that surprises you now that you're sitting there as an observer, watching yourself sitting in the car?
I think it was really great that I still wanted to do film school, that I didn't just drop everything and I was trying to fight to get back in and stay there and still learn. I think that was, you know, pretty not gutsy, but it just shows that I didn't want the cancer to stop me. You know, I still wanted to stay on that path, but it's pretty hard in life when you start something new and it's scary and you're taking a chance and then something goes wrong and you're just kind of left in that limbo state. So that was me kind of trying to take back control. And that's one of the things I really feel like has helped me throughout my life is just taking back control at different points. And that was one way I can take back control. It's like, okay, well, you tell me my film school career is done. I have something different to say. I'm going to find a way to do this.
You won't settle.
Yes.
Like, I'm not going to say, well, okay, I'm done then. Like that's just not in your nature.
Yeah.
Well, and it brings me back to that whole mindset thing is when you made that decision in that moment in the car, you created a mindset that if I'm going to survive this, it's going to take work and this is going to help me make this happen.
Yeah.
That was the mindset. Again, we just keep coming back to that. So now I'm imagining you're talking to that nurse. This must have been a week later. I mean, how it had to have been right around the same time.
It's around the same time, yeah.
Yeah, and you're talking to this nurse, and she's like, "Yeah, you're gonna be fine." Do you remember what she looked like?
I think she had brown hair and glasses. It was 20 years ago. It's really hard to remember.
Oh my gosh, it feels like yesterday as you're telling these stories. Yeah. I only ask that because it seems to me that that was really just as pivotal a moment as sitting in the dark car was that because it's so vivid for you.
Yeah.
You remember the words and you remember her attitude and you may not remember what she looked like, but I feel like I'm sitting there with you in one of those chairs with your arm out, with your blood being drawn.
Yeah.
I guess because I've been there a lot of times having my blood being drawn. And so I'm just imagining that moment where you're like, yeah, you're right. I am going to be okay. Was that kind of the confirmation for you?
It wasn't a, you're right. I am going to be okay. But it was just like, okay, great. She's seen all these other people go through this and she's seen the outcomes and she thinks I'm going to be okay because I'm sitting here smiling while telling her I have cancer. So to hear her say that meant a lot to me.
I think sometimes people underestimate what that means to people. I mean, she probably didn't, because she's been there a long time, and maybe she would have said that regardless. Like, maybe that is part of how she helps cancer patients have the mindset they need to survive.
Yeah, maybe.
That's what I would do.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that what you would do as a human, as a caring human, find a way, find the light for the person near you?
Right. Yeah. I think that'd be a great thing to do. But I think it also depends on the person. Like, if someone's frowning and I think you have to say something different to them.
Yes, absolutely. Cause you have to meet them where they are.
Right.
And probably still make that mindset shift. It would come in different words.
Yeah. I was gonna say, mindset shifts are so huge with everything in life. But for me with cancer, I had a huge mindset shift at one point. Can I tell a story?
Yes, of course. That's your job.
Okay. There was one point where I just found out I had cancer on Thanksgiving. It was the following week, and my boyfriend never called me back. So I left a message with him and telling him I thought I had cancer, and I ended up having cancer, and he never returned the phone call. And then I finally got a hold of him, and he hung up on me. And I remember, so how I found I had cancer was I had a lump on my throat, and it never hurt. And in fact, that was actually one of the bad things, is that it didn't hurt. And after he hung up on me, I was so mad that for the first time I felt pain in that lump that I had found. And in that moment, I knew that I was causing myself harm by being angry. And so I thought, okay, I have to stop this. And I had this like flash to listening to this guy named Zig Ziglar, which love him. And the story he has about being stuck in the airport, his flight was canceled. And instead of him having the reaction that any of us would have of being upset and angry, he said, fantastic. And then went down all of the reasons why it was good that his flight had been canceled. And later on, he said people would ask him, Zig, I've heard about that positive mindset, but come on, did you really say fantastic? Did you really feel that way? He said, well, of course I didn't feel that way, at least not initially. And anyway, so he started thinking of all the reasons why it was good, that there's not, the plane isn't up in the air because maybe there's something wrong with the weather or the pilots or the plane itself. And so he thought it was great that his flight had been canceled. And at least that's what he was telling himself. And I remembered that in that moment of being so angry. And I thought, if Zay can do that with his flight being canceled, I can do that with cancer. And I started thinking of all the reasons why it was good that I had been diagnosed with cancer. And I started coming at it from a grateful perspective instead of being so upset and, you know, looking at all of the negatives. And that mindset shift that you're talking about, it was huge in helping me just get through it whole and not being angry and upset and hurting myself at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I talk about that a lot, about reframing, because that's basically what that is reframing. And again, we come back to neuroscience. Gratitude journals work. They work. I mean, there are all kinds of evidence that people who generally aren't like that, when they start a gratitude journal, if they are consistent with it for a few weeks, it changes their neurochemistry. And so your idea of saying, oh, okay, here are all the reasons this is good, was really, that's where you changed your neural pathways. It changed your brain.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
I love that. I love that. And I think sometimes you knew at that moment you had to do it. I think a lot of times we get stuck in that moment. We don't realize till later that we have to make that change. And my example is that when my father died and I had to fly to Philadelphia to bury him, and on the way back got stuck. It was February and I was stuck in Philadelphia and I didn't really know anyone there. But my sister had a good friend that came to pick me up, drove me into town. I spent the night at a hotel. Then I had this wonderful, kind cab driver drive me back to the airport at 6 a.m. And then I missed another flight because of weather and de-icing. And So it took me a lot longer to get home to my family after this experience. And at the time, it was like the poor me. Oh, great. Now this is happening. Oh, great. Now this is happening. And I just yesterday heard somebody say, well, bad things are always happening to me. And I was like, oh. Of course they do, because that's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
And but I went back to this thing that happened 6 years ago when my father passed. And I remember even then sitting in the airport thinking, okay, if I miss this next flight from Salt Lake to Helena, then I'm stuck in Salt Lake for a night. And how am I going to turn this around? Like that, I just wanted to be home. I wanted to be with my family. My husband and kids were at home. And I'd gone by myself. And I remember this moment of thinking, if I hadn't had that experience of getting stuck in Philadelphia because of the snowstorm, I would have been home and wouldn't have had any time to process the experience of the funeral. I would have just jumped right back into school and work for the boys, work for me. And I wouldn't have taken that time to grieve by myself, which is something I really, really needed.
Mm-hmm.
So even when it's something as hard as cancer or the grief of losing somebody, that mindset shift really has a huge impact.
Yeah, it really does.
It really does. So tell me, did you ever talk to that boyfriend again?
I did. Oh, yeah.
I want to hear that story. I mean, this is, I know it's dirt, but I want to hear it.
Okay, well, he had filmed some stuff, some film of actual film footage of me before I knew I had cancer, but you could see the tumor and I didn't see it. And so I really wanted that footage, and I had my friends like coordinate with him and ask him for the footage. He wouldn't give the footage, but he basically like played it and had them film it. So I had the footage. But then I knew afterwards that I probably had to get a release from him just to cover all my bases, since I'm a producer at this point too. I'm a producer,
right.
I'm an editor. And so after I had been well for maybe a year or so and I had some hair, I went to where he lived before. I hope that he still lived there. I knocked on the door and he saw, oh my gosh, no, it was his girlfriend. His girlfriend actually answered the door and I said, hi, my name is Joy. I just want to talk to Sean for a minute. I wasn't going to use his name, but.
That's okay. I don't know him.
So the door closes and I can see that he's like, he goes up, looks at me through the little peephole, and then they're talking and there's like a little, you know, like he doesn't want to answer the door. And then I think she made him answer the door. And he answered the door. And by the way, I am shaking this entire time. So I have like this little shake in my hands and my heart is beating so much that I could feel it the whole time. So I'm trying to act normal, but my heart is beating out of my chest. And I said, hi, I have some footage that you took and I just wanted to get a release from you just to cover my bases. And he said, oh yeah, sure. So he goes and signs it. And he said, so I heard you were sick or something.
And I said, oh, yeah. What an asshole.
I said, oh yeah, I was sick, but I'm better now. And that was it. That's all I said. And so I got this signed thing, got back in my car, and I was so proud of myself for doing that. And not, it wasn't a time to yell at him. That was his choice. It's not right. About that. But I was so proud that I actually was brave enough to go and face him and get the stuff I needed and walk out of there. So that to me was kind of a closure, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and doing it face to face meant he couldn't really say no to you.
Yeah, right.
He could have said no if you had tried to do it electronically. And by going face to face, I won't call it guilt, but I will say that there it would have been so much harder for him to say no to you face to face. So when you were making your list of all the good things that could come out of having cancer, was one of them, I learned who not to trust, or I know what my deal breakers are.
Yeah. Well, just that it shows the true colors of the people around you. So, and I say that, but I also understand that it's very heavy for people and they may not know what to say or what to do. But I mean, for him, it was just, he just completely dropped me and stopped talking to me. And he was just horrible, really horrible. So I
heard you were sick or something.
Or something. Yeah. It was just, yeah.
What a response. Oh my gosh. You know, it kind of makes me feel sorry for him.
I know. And that's the thing is he, and I knew that he had something with his father dying when he was younger. So, I mean, maybe had something to do with that. We all have our issues. We all have our baggage. I don't know what his were. It was very hurtful at the time and it was hard for me to understand. But what I did, but that was one person that I had do that to me. The rest of it was just all love. Like I just received so much love from my friends, my family. I had a friend from Chicago, this person named Charles, who I told I had cancer, and he was out there by that Friday. I think I told him on a Wednesday. He grabbed a flight out and he spent a couple days there, the weekend there with me. And that to me, that was amazing. I had another friend, Kevin, from film school, who I barely knew. I went to see a couple movies with him, which makes sense, right? Because we're at film school.
Right.
And he sent me flowers when I had my surgery. He got me a director's shirt, and then he'd come over and watch movies with me. And he eventually was there with me for everything. He was there for every single chemotherapy treatment, every blood transfusion. He was there. And then I had another friend. I mean, I had one more friend I'll tell you about. Brian.
Yes, please.
Okay. He was in between jobs. And so he lived on the East Coast and he flew all the way out to California and stayed with us for a couple of months while I was sick, which was perfect because then I had Brian and Kevin, which were friends at that point. And then I could just listen to them talk because I was so tired that I just didn't even want to talk, but I could listen to them talk, which made me happy. And they had each other during that. So it was just amazing, all of the love that I felt during this.
Oh, you just gave me a chill. Brian and Kevin.
Yeah.
So that was at your parents' house in California?
At my aunt's house. So I just left San Diego and moved up to Ventura where she was. And she wanted to help me go to film school. So that's when I found out I was sick. So it all happened at my
aunt's. You happened to be living there anyway.
That happened to me, yeah. It was in my transition.
And just for our listeners, you could look this up on a map, but it's about a 3-4 hour drive to get from San Diego to Ventura. So it makes sense for you to, and that's without traffic.
And that was the other thing. All my friends at SeaWorld, I remember talking to one of my friends when I first found out I was sick, and she said, "Do you want me to tell anyone?" And I said, "Yeah, if there's ever a time to tell anyone, tell my friends, it's now. If there's ever a time I need my friends, it's now." And so they would actually coordinate with each other. Okay, who's going to go up and see Joy this weekend? Okay, I'll go up and I'll cook for her this weekend. I can't because I'm sick. I'm going to stay with her in the hospital. It was amazing. So I had people coming up all the time to see me. I was so blessed to have all the love that I had.
So why focus on the one guy that didn't know what to do?
But you know what? That's
what he just didn't know what to do.
Didn't know what to do.
When you said that he lost a parent at an early age, that immediately triggered that thought. Like he couldn't, his survival brain kicked in, the fight, flight, or freeze, and he flew away because he knew he could not handle another person dying in his life. He just was not in that place. He didn't know consciously, because if he did, he probably would have just said, "I can't."
Right.
And he would have just ghosted you. But I keep coming back to this guy, and as horrible as that is, I keep thinking we are such complicated humans.
Right.
And thank goodness you had all this other support. What a beautiful experience. Wow.
It actually was. And as horrible as it sounds that I had cancer, it was wonderful to feel all this love. Because it's almost like you don't show that much love to the people in your life that you do care for, unless it's an emergency. It's something that happens where you do that. So I got to almost, this sounds horrible, but to see, be at my own funeral in a sense and see all the love and feel that love in when I was still alive. So I think that was one of the biggest blessings of my life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, to be able to see your legacy in action.
Yeah.
Most people don't ever get that opportunity. And it's sad that it takes that, but that's what life is about. We're busy. We're doing our things and our lives are our own, but to be able to see your legacy before you leave is just, that's amazing, because it really demonstrates the impact you've had on the people in your life, that they would come to you in that way and say, "You're not in this alone. You have had such a big impact on my life that I am going to make damn sure that you don't feel alone right now." That's what they were saying in all of their actions.
Yeah. It's so funny when you said that, it reminded me of this guy, Hoppy, who had cancer, and he said, hun, I don't care what happens. If I have to carry you across that finish line, you're going to make it through this. And so, I mean, I didn't know him before this. He just popped into my life from SeaWorld. He just found out I had cancer and he drove all the way up and would spend time with me in the hospital or at my aunt's house. So it was wonderful. I could go on and on about that.
Well, that's the part I like to hear, because what that tells people, what our listeners are hearing, is that aspect of your story. And so many times I've said this, when you talk about your struggle and the things that have happened in your life that have created those obstacles and challenges, let's say you have, you know, this full story that you tell, only 10 to 15% of it should be about the struggle. The rest should be about the survival, the resilience, the persistence in facing that obstacle.
Right.
So the way you're telling the story right now, we've heard maybe 10% of it being scary and uncomfortable and fearful. And then the rest of it is, all these people showed up for me. Mm-hmm. My legacy was in my face. And so few people get that opportunity to see their legacy like that.
Yeah.
And so I'm loving this. I have to come back. I'm imagining you being so tired, so fatigued, and having Brian and Kevin sitting in the room with you, just chit-chatting, and you're just kind of there observing, just having that company. Do you remember that? Do you have like a visual memory of that?
Oh yeah. Well, I have one memory that I just love. I love charades. And so I had just been rushed to the hospital because I had a fever and I was low on my blood counts and I needed blood transfusion. And so I was getting my blood transfusion and I was really tired. So I was closing my eyes and I said, let's play charades. And they said, okay. And I closed my eyes. They said, but aren't you going to watch? Aren't you going to play? I said, no, I'm too tired, but I want you to play. I want to listen to it. And so they actually played charades. And I, with my eyes closed, I just threw out one guess of what it was. And I was right. It was Titanic. And I heard one of them say, how did you know that? And I don't know, it's just really funny. So I sat there in my bed, tired, feeling horrible, but then smiling because I, you know, had this little situation that made me laugh. But it was just wonderful to have them there all the time. And I have footage of them there too, that they took of themselves when they're in the hospital, or that I would take of them with me.
So for our listeners, do we have access to watch this film?
Yeah, I just recently put it on YouTube. I've been selling it for a while, but I just wanted to put it out so more people can see it. And it's, how would you look it up? Can I give you the link to it?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I can associate, in the blog post associated with this podcast, I will link to it. So if you could send that to me in an email, that would be great.
Okay. The name of it is Just 1 Year, A Story of Triumph Over Cancer.
Just
1 Year.
Oh, okay.
A story of triumph over cancer.
Just 1 year, a story of triumph over cancer. Well, anyone could look that up too. And they can look up your name. But this is your married name.
Yes.
Did you do this before you were married?
Yes.
And what was your maiden name, if you don't mind my asking?
It was Clausen, C-L-A-U-S-E-N.
Okay. But I'll also have a link. So our listeners, you don't have to jot all that down. Just come to my website, elkinsconsulting.com, and there will be a link to the film. So when you finished the film, I mean, I'm assuming that it was after you were in remission that you were able to really finish it.
Yeah, it took me a while to finish it because I was actually in limbo for a really long time after the cancer. Because they say, okay, great, you're cancer-free. Go back to normal life.
And it's like, right.
Yeah, I'm bald. My muscles have atrophied. I just survived something really intense. So there's no normal life for me right now. So I was actually in limbo, especially because I made that transition from working with animals to filmmaking. And I kind of lost that. So I was in limbo for about 5 years, honestly. It was a long time. And I was working on the documentary, but I couldn't finish it because I wasn't happy with my ending. And so finally, many years later, I ended up going back to SeaWorld and I started a program for kids who have cancer from Rady Children's Hospital and Children's Hospital Los Angeles, which is actually, that's the hospital that I was treated at, where they can come to the park and get in the water to meet a dolphin. And so I ended now with that, but it took me until 2008 when I finished it. And I went to film festivals, which was great, and won some awards. So it was a really good experience.
Wow. 5 years in limbo. What were you doing in that time? Were you still living with your aunt in Ventura?
No, I moved out of there, but I went to film school again at actually a better film school. I went to the American Film Institute for a year, but I was in a track because when you go to film school there, you have to go in different tracks. So there's directing and there's producing and there's production design. There's all these different places. And so I happened to go into producing, but my other school wasn't like that. So when I got into it, I didn't realize it was only producing. And so I did a year there. And I barely had any hair. It was super, super short. And then after that, I just kind of worked in restaurants trying to finish the documentary, and I was just lost. So, and then
that's
finally,
a long time.
A long time to be lost, right?
When did you start the program for, how did that happen? I know we need to wrap up here pretty soon, but how did that happen? Was that in those 5 years that you started to be inspired to do something like that?
Well, I've always wanted to do something to give back, but there was a specific reason why I did that. There was one of my roommates at Children's Hospital Los Angeles was this little five-year-old girl who had leukemia, and she was just wonderful. And we became really close. Whenever I'd be there at the hospital, we'd be roommates. And so I remember when I got my job back at SeaWorld, the first thing I did was I called her up. I said, I'm going to be working there again, and I can bring you in the water and we can meet a dolphin together. And she was really excited. At that point, she was much older because, you know, leukemia takes a longer time to go through. And, so I set something up, and then it didn't work out for whatever reason, and they canceled. So we didn't have it that day, and then it just didn't happen for a while. And I ended up finding out that she had passed away. I got a call from her mom saying that she passed away, and they actually tried getting a hold of me, but they lost my phone number. So that dream that I had of us, because I would dream about it when we were bald in the hospital together, is of us going with our hair back in, you know, we're healthy and we're meeting a dolphin and this wonderful moment. And I could not let go of it. And I remember talking to my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband. And he asked me what my dreams were. And I said, I actually paused because I didn't want to tell him because I knew that wasn't a feasible dream, but I had nothing else in my head because this is all I could think about. And so I said, well, my dream was to bring Bailey into the water to meet a dolphin, but I can't do that anymore. And he said, well, why does it have to end? Why can't you do something like start a program where kids from Children's Hospital who have cancer can come to the park and get in the water to meet a dolphin? And then he said, and it can be annual. I'm like, oh, that sounds amazing. So, I mean, it really came from him. And then I made a proposal. I went to work and showed them the proposal. I was already set up to fight for it. So anything that they'd say, no, we can't do it because of this or this, I had reasons why it would work. And I went to them, I presented it, and right away they said, yes, this is a no-brainer. And so we started our first program, and every year we would have people from Rady's and from Children's Hospital Los Angeles come in. So that was really cool. And then for me, one of the most important things was not just, you know, the experience of being a dolphin, but for them to see me healthy.
As a survivor.
Yes. That's huge, because then they have that visualization like, okay, well, she made it. If she can make it, then so can I. And that's all I wanted to see when I was sick, was that story of survival. Or I remember asking someone who was in a therapy group, like, did you have cancer? Because you looked healthy and fine. And she said, no, I didn't have cancer. So I didn't really have any of those examples. And so I wanted to be an example for these kids that, you know, you can make it through this and then go and get your dream job. I mean, look at this. I'm at a physical job. It's amazing. I'm happy. And so it was really, really cool to do that and to share that with the kids. And they'd get really excited when I tell them that. So, yeah.
So it was really Bailey's legacy. That program was her legacy.
It is. And I was never, I'd be interviewed for it afterwards. Sometimes there'd be press there, mm-hmm. and I could never talk about her. So only now after, so that was 2008. So now it's what, 12 years later? Only now can I talk about her and not just lose it. Because it's so hard.
Yeah, but I'm almost crying right here just hearing about it. And I don't know her.
Right. I know. And she was so wonderful. So I think that for me feels like it's a theme of my life, is that I run into these obstacles and then I just find a way. You know, like that's how we should all do it. We should all just look for that way to make something work, and it may not be the same as what you thought it was going to be, but it could be something even more beautiful. You know, there's hundreds of kids that have gone through that program who, mm-hmm. I mean, their parents were crying and they were doing things that they'd never done before and smiling and, you know, active, and it was just a really wonderful experience. So, I think that never give up on your dreams, because mm-hmm. there's always a way to make it happen.
But there are two parts to that. It's not just not giving up on your dreams. It's not just having an obstacle and choosing the mindset to get around it. It's also surrounding yourself with people who believe in it.
Yes.
Or believe in you. And who is in your life makes all the difference in your happiness and survival and success. It's not just survival, it's thriving. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking about all the people you talked about that you were staying with your aunt, and, you know, somebody that believed in you enough to say, come live with me while you're in film school. Mm-hmm. And then the people from San Diego, from SeaWorld, that you had worked with, and somebody Hoppy that you didn't even know. And leaving that legacy of care wherever you are builds that community around you. And that's what you did. That's what makes you so resilient. And I think sometimes we underestimate that, you know, because we make it about us. Mm-hmm. And it is, to a certain extent, because we have to be the people that bring those people into our lives. But we have to behave that way. We have to be the people we want in our lives in order to attract those particular people. And I think sometimes we underestimate that because we get so about ourselves. You know, this is my journey. It's about me, but it's really not. It's never. So yeah. I love your stories. And I have to ask, did Bailey's parents know that you started this program, and have you talked to them?
I just let her know recently that because for the Man and Woman of the Year, I was doing it in Bailey's honor. And so I contacted her mom to make sure that it was okay. And then I said, by the way, I've also done this. And it was because I really couldn't talk about it before. It was too hard for me to talk about it. And so she said, oh my gosh, I had no idea. And so she was in tears. I mean, I have this whole message of her just sobbing while she's so grateful to, you know, the Bailey's memory is still being kept alive and all that. So mm-hmm. it was really wonderful.
Oh,
yeah.
You're making me cry. And well, I had to ask that question, and I knew that it was going to bring up some emotion, and I apologize if that is uncomfortable, but I think as a parent, hearing that story and hearing that you continued that program, or you started that program because of this dream with Bailey, that is so meaningful to those parents, because there's a point, and you know this, there's a point where when something traumatic happens, you find out who your real friends are. And some people, like your boyfriend at the time, choose to flee. They just can't live with what they know is going to happen to you. They just can't witness it because it's too painful for them. And it's too real. It's too close to home. In his case, too close to his experience with a parent when he was little. And in most cases, parents of children who die have to find other parents of children who die to be able to be whole again in any way, because they can't share that grief with parents who haven't had that experience. And parents who haven't had that experience often will leave. They just can't. They can't be with you because it's too real, mm-hmm. and they don't want to live that grief. Mm-hmm. And so for you to start that program in honor of Bailey for your relationship with her, her parents needed to know. They needed to know that. It brings kind of a wholeness that is, it will never be there again, but it definitely contributes to filling that. So I'm thanking you for them, even though it has nothing to do with me, because of that legacy that you leave everywhere you seem to go, which is, I'm so glad that we connected. So one last story that I would love to hear from you is your TEDx, when you finished it. You do the TEDx, you walk off the stage. What happened? What was that?
What was that? Well, I messed up a little bit. You can't really tell. You can't tell. But I knew it word for word. And so I had done it the day before, because you do a run through the day before. I nailed it. And then I messed up just slightly at the very end of my speech. Like I said, you can't tell, but I felt not as good as I should have after I walked off the stage.
Just a little picky, huh?
Because that's it. It's not like I get to present that speech again at another TEDx and that's it. I'm done. That was it. So, I felt like I knew I did a really good job with delivering it, because, when you go up there, there's just lights in your face. I couldn't see the audience. And I was just so thankful. I was so well prepared to go up there, and I had the speech memorized. And I think it was just more like just questioning it and thinking, I could have done better, and not really giving myself grace afterwards. I think I'm harder on myself than I should be.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. So you're kind of kicking yourself. Who was the first person that talked to you afterward?
I think it was my husband and I saw some friends. I had my best friend there and another friend that's a photographer, and they all said I did a fantastic job. And I had some people from my Toastmasters group
awesome.
That ended up being there. They didn't know I was going to be on stage. And then,
oh my gosh.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Because I just competed in Toastmasters for the district level. And so I, came in second for district, and these people had seen me there less than a month before, and then I'm up at TEDx. They weren't expecting
it.
It was funny.
But so when you walked off the stage, do you walk straight into the audience, or do you go backstage?
No, you go backstage. So he
and
said,
who was there?
What they tell you to do is like take a moment and then walk off stage. And so my moment was probably a nanosecond, and then I walked off stage, and then I just kind of decompressed for a minute, and then I came back out and found my family after that. So,
so you went back and sat in the audience.
It doesn't work like that where we did it. You don't just go into the audience, but you have to go back, and then we had to go like down some stairs and out a back way and around to like the back of the auditorium is how it worked. And so, I just saw them afterwards, and they were also happy and proud of me and thought I did amazing. So it felt really good to do that.
Of course it did. That's huge. I call those rock star moments, but they're actually almost literal for you when you're on stage like that, to feel that sense of accomplishment and connection with the audience.
Yeah.
Because clearly that happened. And I guess the reason I ask you to kind of go back to those moments is because I find that when we look back to the immediate moments following an experience like that, we see things that we wouldn't otherwise see. So for instance, the being really hard on yourself. Being able to look back and say, wow, I was really hard on myself. And that was my first instinct, was to criticize my one bit that clearly had no impact, zero impact on how people received my presentation.
Yeah.
Zero impact. But your first instinct was to kick yourself over it, to be punishing yourself in some way. And I think that's really telling, because many of us do that. Some of us learn not to, which is pretty amazing. But one of my friends that I just recently interviewed for my podcast, she said that in her master's program, one of her professors said, you are not responsible for your first thought, because that is a product of how you grow up, all of your experiences, your environment, all those things. That first thought is your natural instinctive thought. But she said, you are responsible for every thought following that one.
I love that.
Yes, I've been using it all the time. I need to actually let her know that I keep using it. Alana Sheeran, she is also a film producer in the Ventura area.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yes, and she's doing a film called Listen Closely. And it's I'm so excited for this film. But anyway, when she told me that story, it immediately made me feel better about that first thought, because we really don't have control over that. It's something that happens. But if you look back at that moment, the immediate moment following the TEDx, and you walk off the stage and you're like, damn, I missed that one word, that you're not responsible for.
Okay.
But you are responsible for every thought after that, which is no one noticed. It didn't detract in any way from how it was received. I nailed every other part of it, which is 99.9%. And I feel really good about what I just did there because it was hard and I was in the arena, you know, the whole Roosevelt speech. You were the person in the arena and you did it. And that is a phenomenal accomplishment.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, you're right. I was in the arena.
You were in the arena. Oh, Joy, this has been, well, it's been a joy. I know you get that a lot, but I had to say it. Thank you for joining me on Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. You're kind of the poster child for that.
Thank you so much. It's been so great talking to you and actually meeting you. I can see, I know it's a podcast right now, but I can see you now, which is wonderful because I felt this immediate connection to you when we met on LinkedIn.
Me too. Me too. So for our listeners, you will be able to connect with Joy on LinkedIn. I will have her LinkedIn profile on the blog post associated with this podcast, as well as the link to her film, Just One Year, A Story of Triumph Over Cancer. And I will have a few other links, like to her TEDx video, and maybe a few photos if she is willing to share. And of course, the Zig Ziglar quote. So thank you again, Joy. And I am looking forward to keeping an eye on your story.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you for listening to Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. If you're planning an event or company retreat and want to bring in a memorable, entertaining, and highly practical speaker as your keynote speaker or workshop facilitator, please visit us at elkinsconsulting.com to learn how we can help and provide a memorable keynote or breakout session. Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you.
Listen to me, honey, while I say, how could you tell me that you're going away?